right, mates. Cheeky Volley, episode 32. Perhaps the first time in a while we're doing two episodes within this short of a time frame. This is the men's final recap of Wimbledon. What's up, Dan?
Hey, what's up, guys?
Asher, what time is it in London?
Only 11:30 for this one.
Did you check out of the hotel?
Pretty early.
All right, mate.
Yeah, checked out.
Give us a quick recap.
The market, by the way, is not very bullish on Cheeky Volley going forward because we've upped our podcast production by 67% this weekend. So expect a big stock price jump when market opens on tomorrow morning.
Ticker Cheek.
Futures traders, take note. All right, mate, give us a quick recap. What happened today?
Sure, very quick recap. I think there was kind of five distinct parts of the match. So part one, first set, Novak is just playing absolutely peak prime. I haven't seen this level from him. He showed it a bit at the Australian Open, but he's been so dominant in majors in the last few years. He often just wins with his B or his C game, and he only brings his A game when he needs to in the tiebreaks. But this time it was everything about him. Like he was suffocating him with his return of serve. His first serve was going in 76%. His defense was where it always is. He was hitting flat winners, drop shots. Carlitos kind of got smashed in the face a bit to start, and he wasn't really in it that set. He won 1 point on his second serve in the set. But I have this theory, having seen Federer, Nadal in the past, and a lot of these good players, that often when you play too well in the first set, your level drops quite significantly, and dealing with that drop is often hard because you're playing free flowing, and it's very hard to maintain that, and it's very rare that someone will maintain that for more than one set, and that's kind of what happened at the start of the second. Carlos started improving, he started unlocking his forehand. Novak's first serve percentage dropped a lot. The wind kind of started playing around a bit. So it got a lot tighter. Carlos broke straight away, but Novak broke straight back. And then it was a really excellent second set, to be honest. We were really enjoying it on our group chat. It was extremely close. We didn't really know how it would go. In the tiebreak, though, Novak has won 16 tiebreaks in a row at Grand Slams. He got a 6-5 set point, and he played two awful backhands, both into the net. Would never expect him to miss those. And then Alcaraz hit a great backhand return winner down the line on set point, took the set. To be fair, he was the better player in the set, I think. Slightly better player, but Novak, he's definitely going to regret those two backhands. Then the next part of the match, Alcaraz full momentum, playing his absolute best. Wins the third set very easily. They had an epic 25-minute game. And then you think that Novak might run away with it, and then Novak takes a nice bathroom break at the beginning of the fourth set to try and ice him. saves two huge break points early in the fourth, which was the match essentially. And then Carlos misses an easy forehand volley at 30-15 in his next service game, and after that Novak doesn't miss for 45 minutes. So then the momentum completely flips on its head, and I don't think anyone thought going into the fifth that Carlos was going to win. I mean, Novak looked just dominant, and Carlos started looking a bit leggy. He seemed to be missing a bit. Didn't really feel like he had many solutions. And then we get into the next part of the game, which was the beginning of the fifth, where it seems like Novak has all the momentum. Carlos has an incredible hold at 1-0, which basically was the match. And Novak hadn't missed for like 45 minutes by this point. And then just to win points, Carlos had to go drop shot winner, drop volley winner, two defensive slices to save break point. And he got a really awkward lob for Novak, which looked worse for Novak than it was. I have sympathy that he missed that shot because it looked like it might be going out. Then it kind of was sliding back in. Then he hit a drop shot winner, forehand winner, incredible save. And an incredible break point in the next game where it was a crazy point, and he ended up hitting a backhand down the line passing shot, and then Novak completely smashed his racket. So it was dark energy maybe gone too far. And that was kind of the match there. Novak didn't really recover to the level he was at. He got a bit tight getting at 15-30 in a couple of games. But Carlos was really fearless in that last game. Loved that last game. He went for a drop shot, lost it, went for another drop shot lob, which was amazing. An incredible backhand volley winner the next point, and then he kind of took it home. And he's now 9-1 in 5-set matches.
Asher, as always, once again, top form, exceptionally analytical. That was great. Dan, any comments?
Yeah, I mean, an incredible final. The quality of play, actually, I thought was quite wide. I thought you saw somewhat poor play from both players at different times. And I also thought you saw some of the best play of the tournament and probably some recent Wimbledons at the same time as well. And what I thought was so interesting was the kind of evolution of Wimbledon play over the last decade or so that was on full display in this final. We've talked on other podcasts about the slowing down of Wimbledon, but these were two sort of peak movers that were just stretching the court so wide and extending the rally so far that I don't think I can recall seeing where like both sides of the court were able to sort of dole out the same medicine in the same way. And I thought that, yeah, like Carlos came out first set. I would, looking at the scoreline, you think, oh, he must have been nervous. But to Asher's point, like Djokovic was just absolute A-game, redlining it from the first point that entire set. It was a remarkable thing to watch. And then for Carlos, knowing he didn't really have his game up and running yet midway through the second set, to just kind of stick it out and get to a tiebreaker, I thought was really impressive. Kind of basically Carlos's mental fortitude throughout the entirety of the match, knowing that he didn't have what he wanted to bring to the game at different points. Kudos to him. Kind of another accolade for being 20 years old and having that kind of head on his shoulders. It was really impressive to watch. And then I think you could make an argument that Djokovic got a little bit tight. Certainly those two backhands were very uncharacteristic of him. But I also think that Carlos stepped it up big time. He made the necessary adjustments where, you know, there were times in the match where Djokovic's return was so spot on that Carlos was immediately on the back foot and had no opportunity to get into the point. I think he made the necessary adjustments, and he also stopped going for big winners early in points. I think historically that's kind of the way that you beat Djokovic, is that you take it right to him and you just take the racket out of his hand. That wasn't working for him today, and instead he had to extend the points to where they're, you know, 7-shot rallies, 8, 9, 10-shot rallies. And I thought that he, you know, really stayed within himself and eventually just kind of opportunities presented and he executed.
I think one thing I was particularly impressed with Carlos is that if you often look at the matches against the GOAT gen, people often they'll redline for a bit and then they'll get up, and then it kind of fluctuates with just their level. And it's very hard to redline against the GOAT gen for 3 out of 5 sets. But he had a strategy and he stuck to stuff that wasn't necessarily working all the time, which a lot of guys don't do. It's another way to describe it, making good errors. So there's a few times where he went for drop shots and Novak got to them quite easily and he lost the point. But he didn't stop trying to hit the drop shot. So that just showed he was fearless and he was going to stick to his strategy. He wasn't just going to change his strategy up just on the basis that he was losing a couple of points. So I really appreciated that about his performance today, because even I was actually yelling at him to stop playing drop shots. But
I think that's completely...
Thank God he didn't listen to me.
That's spot on. And to your point, I think what makes his commitment to that tactical approach all the more fascinating here is just looking at the manner in which he lost that first set, to commit to it, win the second set in a breaker, run with the third, the belief he had, really. I mean, more so than any match, any final can recall in the last 5 years, he really took it from Djokovic. It was such an impressive performance.
Yeah, I think that this was a great display of sort of where Carlos can go in his evolution. And what I mean by that is we think of him as this explosive player that can rip winners from anywhere in the court, hyper aggressive. This was sort of him realizing that either because he didn't have his A game or because he's playing, you know, the GOAT, he had to extend rallies. He wasn't just able to pull the trigger off, you know, the second ball, the third ball. He had to be very, very disciplined. And you saw that. And I think that that's an element of his game that he's going to be able to cultivate because he's so fit that half the people he's playing, he doesn't have to rip winners off of. He can just break them down, very similar to the way that Rafa breaks down opponents or Djokovic breaks down opponents. So I'm really interested to see kind of on an evolution whether or not he incorporates that into his game when either the matchup doesn't play to his strengths or he just doesn't have his A game.
And his game style is actually well suited to that because he obviously can hit the flat, huge forehand in the same manner Federer did. But as we saw today, he has this very good, very high margin for error, high over the net, heavy forehand as well that he can grind players down with too. So that's more of the Rafa part of his game coming through than the Federer part.
Yeah, agreed.
It's amazing. One thing I noticed, his forehand on the run, one of the reasons, again, I think it's so good, and I might be a little bit off about this, but I'm curious to get your perspective on this. You know, oftentimes when he preps his forehand, his left hand's not actually touching the racket. So when he's on the run and he's doing an abbreviated backswing where he doesn't have enough time or space to get his left arm around, it's actually not that different from the way he normally preps a shot. And he's able to still get his arm straight through it. It's interesting to see it in slow motion. Maybe we can post a video about that. 66 winners over five sets. Djokovic hit 32. Djokovic only two aces across five sets.
That's wild.
A testament to how good Alcaraz's return is. One interesting stat, we talked about this briefly, but in the fourth set, the Joker won. He won 67% of second serve points.
Hmm.
That was a key.
Yeah, I think.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, just I think this was, even though he lost in the finals, I thought this was one of Djokovic's best serving performances over the course of a 2-week slam. We've talked in recent years about the Djokovic serve getting bigger, probably because he's trying to shorten points as he gets older. But his serve was great. There was a bit of a lull in his service performance, maybe like late third through mid fifth. I thought his level dropped. But overall, looking at, you know, Wimbledon 23, I thought he served great and really great clutch serving, whether he's down break point, hitting a second serve or, you know, 15-40 or whatever it was. Like at the big moments, he was able to cook up amazing serves. And even though he only had two aces, it did not feel like he wasn't getting free points off of his serve. I saw a lot of Alcaraz, returns going long. So I think the two aces is a little bit misleading.
And he also hit a lot of great second serves. And in the last three games, I think at his last three matches at Wimbledon, his first serve was really good, but he threw in a lot of shaky, short, like 85 mile an hour second serves that they got like Hurkacz, Rublev, Sinner could not take advantage of. And it didn't feel like Alcaraz had tons of those to go after today.
One question. Where was the Joker's backhand up the line today? Didn't seem to be on. He didn't seem to go up the line as much. I don't know if that's.
I think it was partly strategic because I did see him just trying to keep away from the Alcaraz forehand as much as possible.
Yeah, staying away from that side.
Yeah.
Yeah. I also think that when they were in the backhand to backhand rally, Djokovic loves receiving a flat ball and just doing that sort of abbreviated touch swing where he counters it up the line so effectively. I actually thought when they were in the backhand to backhand, Alcaraz was hitting very topspin heavy and not pulling Djokovic that far out wide. It was a little bit more up the middle. So he kind of not only took away the angle, but he also took away the kind of ball that Djokovic loves to redirect off of.
Yeah, some of those 10, 15 shot backhand to backhand rallies, unreal. Can we talk a bit more about the fifth? Because at the end of the fourth, the beginning of the fifth, we spoke a lot on the chat about how Joker was channeling the dark energy and he was playing like a wall. There were a few games early in the fifth where it looked like, all right, he's done it again. He's about to run with it. He doesn't lose fifth sets. And what happened there?
Yeah, I think that game where Alcaraz, he like just dug deep and produced some incredible shots out of the bag to hold. And then he gained a lot of confidence from that. Then he broke the next game. And then it was a very weird position for Novak to be in. And I think he himself was pretty surprised that he was in that position. So he kind of lost it himself after that, after the racket smash. He got to 15-30 in a couple of games, and he hit some really bad errors, like a return error off a second serve. He never misses a forehand error. Then he started blaming the wind. But that was one of the cool things about the fifth set as well, I think, is that it was more Alcaraz digging deep and finding something incredible from his arsenal to counter Novak, rather than Novak kind of giving it away.
Yeah, I thought there were two interesting elements in the fifth set, or maybe one's an anecdote, one's an element. But the first was when Djokovic got down the break early and we were kind of mid-set where, you know, Alcaraz is serving 3-2 or 4-3, it still felt like a 50-50, i.e.
Yeah,
Djokovic being down a break is the natural handicap to make that an even match. But the piece that I thought was really interesting was Djokovic was – maybe not quite fourth set wall, but he was still wall-esque throughout most of the fifth. And usually when he goes into that mode, his opponent knows it, and his strokes are so superior from a rally perspective than his opponent that it's just a waiting game, right? Either the opponent gets impatient, the opponent makes an error, the opponent goes for a low margin shot, whatever it is. It looked like Alcaraz just completely said, game on. Like, you want to extend points, you want to become a wall, well, I'll be a wall too. I have complete faith in my strokes. I have faith in my movement. I see you, and I'm not backing down. And I think it was certainly the first player of, you know, this generation or the mid generation that the energy on court said, you know, I'll go wall to wall, toe to toe with you any day. And he held up to it.
Yeah, and Novak, it's not like he hasn't been in a fifth set against other guys in the last like 6 years since in his second era, like when he started winning slams again after 2018. I think he had a five-setter against Zverev at the US Open. He won that. He had a five-setter against Tsitsipas in the final. He won that. It's like in none of those, he had a five-setter against Sinner at Wimbledon last year. In none of these matches, I think we've ever felt that he was going to lose. And I think in this one, like, it's a testament to how good Alcaraz is, both from a game and mental perspective, that we thought that it was like 50-50 and that he could definitely win.
And that he won with one break as opposed to going to a breaker.
Mm.
So after the match, I went on a long run thinking about the match. One aspect that I still don't have clarity on, and it'll probably trouble me for some time, why did Djokovic not wear the cap today? we've had this theory that, you know, over the last year and a half, in some of his bigger matches, when things get weird and he starts looking at squinting his eyes and, you know, trying to open up the diaphragm and increase his breathing, we notice that he'll put a cap on and then he'll go on a tear and play unreal villainous tennis for two or three sets. He didn't do it today. What's going on?
I think we got to blame Goran for that one. Like, he gets paid to be his coach, so he's got to like have a gesture, get the cap on.
Speaking of Goran, what I'm loving about this new rule where you're allowed to coach from the box is just the antics between Joker and his box throughout the match. Goran very animated, Joker very animated. It's a lot of fun to watch.
It was fairly subdued today because I think Djokovic, I don't think he felt like he was playing bad. I think if he was reflecting on the match, he doesn't say, you know, again, with the exception of the third set, his performance was not particularly bad. Going back to the cap, I think it's that when I see the cap come out, I say to myself, all right, Djokovic isn't going to miss a ball for the next 45 minutes to 2 hours, however long it takes. Like, to me, The cap is emblematic of Djokovic wall mode engaged. He was already able to do that. It's not as though he had to change his game to achieve what he wanted to do. He was playing the way that he wanted to play. He just couldn't execute enough. I think partly it was the court. I think he saw pretty good wear on the court by that point, and maybe he was a little bit more gingerly than Alcaraz was moving around. He probably got a few unlucky breaks and sliding or slipping here and there. But yeah, I feel like the cap was specifically designed to engage wall mode, and he didn't need any help in doing that.
That's well said.
Okay, so Goran can keep his job. He he realized that.
Yeah, I think that you win the year's first two majors and you make it to a fifth set in the final of the third, you should have some job security there.
By the way, does anyone actually, so I got this text today from my brother, like, what does Goran actually do?
It's a great question. I don't know. I think about that often. If you ask Patrick McEnroe, he had a comment during this tournament. He said it with a high degree of conviction. He said, Goran made Joker a complete player.
That I take issue with that.
Ridiculous to me. That's nonsensical. He joined him later in his career. And as Dan said, and I think this is totally accurate, Marian Vida made him a complete player.
100%. I think that if Djokovic retired when Vida left his camp with whatever the number is, someone will have to look this up, but I don't know, 14 majors, 16, whatever the number is, like, he's already a complete player. He's already in the upper echelon of the upper echelon of tennis history. So no, Goran did not make him a complete player. I think Goran probably improved his serve, which has become a much more impactful shot at this quote unquote late stage in Djokovic's career. But at this rate, late, maybe when he's like 55. So yes, I'm sure Goran has helped around the edges, no question. I think that they have a very strong personal relationship, perhaps both having been, you know, touring professionals. And also maybe like they kind of both came to each other as adults. I know Vida was with Djokovic for a very long time, and maybe there was some sort of age gap element that played into that. And I think also, if I recall correctly, Vida wanted to work with younger talent. So no, Goran did not make him a complete player. He was already a fully baked player by the time Vida left the camp. I think he's just gotten even more dangerous around the edges, partly as a function of Goran.
Well said. And also, Vida, I think he is still coaching. I think he might be, to your point, I think he's coaching Alex Molcan, the lefty.
That's right.
Right, yeah. Who's pretty good, yeah. What does this match say, if anything, about the rest of the year for Joker as we look to hard court season, indoor season, World Tour finals, which maybe we're not as concerned about, but US Open?
Yeah, I think...
a bit more vulnerable on a hard court, isn't he?
Yeah, not just for Joker, but I think it's great for tennis in general because we've got a really good rivalry again. If like the last four majors, they're both 2-2, although Novak didn't play US Open last year, Alcaraz didn't play Australian Open this year. They're both extremely close in world ranking points. Alcaraz has just taken a slightly bigger lead because he's won Wimbledon. Novak will be able to play the US hard court swing this year, so he's going to be able to catch up some more points. And he's definitely a bit more vulnerable. So even though we have this good rivalry, I think the hard court season will be even better because we have these two, and Medvedev is kind of on the same level as these guys on the North American hard court. So I think the rest of the year looks pretty exciting for tennis as a whole, for Novak in particular. I think people were getting a bit carried away after he won the French. And I think some Mats Wilander said he's going to get to 30. I've always been on the opposite side.
Remember, Mats Wilander also said Casper Ruud was going to beat Federer when they played 3 years ago at the French Open. So,
I think when you get to that age, like people's levels can drop very quickly. So it's often like falling off a cliff face. So Federer, when he won his last major, people thought that he was going to get four or five more because he was looking pretty dominant. He had won three out of his last four. because he hadn't played the French. He won like Aussie Open, Wimbledon. Then he only didn't win the US Open because he injured his back, and then he won Aussie Open again. And people thought he'd had at least 1-2 years more winning majors, and he didn't win any more. And with Novak, he won the French, but I honestly think Alcaraz would have beaten him if he hadn't got cramps. So I'm not sure. Like, I think how many more he wins? I think he wins at least one more, maybe two more. I don't think he wins 5 or 6 more.
Yeah, I think the arc of Novak, even though he's sustained such a high level so many years into a career that we've kind of never seen that before, I have to think that the end of his career will look similar to other greats, i.e., to your point, it will drop off at a precipitous clip, at least in terms of titles won. But we may not be there yet, right? Like he's won two this year. He made the finals at Wimbledon. Like, it could be next year. It could be in 4 years that we reach that. But at some point, we're going to reach that and we'll start to slide in traditional fashion. I think speaking for Novak at the US Open, I really like his chances. I think that the hard courts are a bit of a, call it equalizing factor for more of the field. But I think he also has an enormous amount to prove right now. And I think also not having won Wimbledon takes the pressure of the calendar slam off his shoulders. And I think that'll be really liberating. So to me, the cocktail of being one of, if not the greatest hard court players, having a lot to prove, especially against the field now that he's been made to look vulnerable, and not having to deal with the pressures of 2021 going for the calendar slam, I think all work in his favor.
Yep. Yep. Well said. I think I'm actually pretty excited. So like looking at Alcaraz now, I'm actually pretty excited for what this win means for him, because it's such a huge win. And when he won his first major, it didn't really feel like a win because Novak didn't play. Like Federer was not in the field. Rafa was not in the field either, I don't think. So, oh no, Rafa was in the field, but he lost to Tiafoe. It wasn't like full strength Rafa. So it didn't feel like an authentic major victory. And this absolutely feels like an authentic major victory. In fact, it's one of the best major victories of the last 10 years. It's very, we talked a lot about this. It was very I'm him, a very I'm him moment. And it comes at a good time, because getting cramps in the semis in the third set was not a good look. It was very much the opposite of I'm him. So to get that back like this quickly is really good. I think he's going to take a ton of confidence from this, and his level is going to start improving a lot as well.
I think what'll be interesting is to see what does his hard court schedule look like. We know that his game takes a very high toll on the body. He's defending champion. He's number one in the world. So does he play, you know, Cincinnati? Does he play Montreal? Does he play all these? Does he play DC? What does his schedule look like? And does it afford him the time that he needs on court while also preserving, enough gas in the tank to make a 2-week run?
Yeah, great point. Cincinnati and Montreal should be okay. Like last year, he was playing Umag and Hamburg. So I'm not sure if he should go back and do another clay court swing.
Umag, Gastad, and Bastard. Some of our favorite tournaments.
Kabir and Daniel. I'm looking at the
entry list for the DC City Open. It looks like Alcaraz is not playing, but Taylor Fritz is. So we'll attend.
Dan and Kabir, during the trophy presentation, we were enjoying how Kate Middleton was like stopping and speaking to the ball kids, and then she was like giving Novak a good pep talk. Do you think Kate Middleton is going to be watching ATP Umag?
Unlikely.
Are you sure? As patron of Wimbledon, she should be a big tennis fan, no?
Yeah.
Umag, she might be called to other official duties.
We need to get her on the pod.
Two things before we sign off here. So one, again, going back to the hard court, I'm curious. If we see, and you know, this high likelihood we see a US Open final, Djokovic and Alcaraz, tactically, would you expect a similar match as what we saw today, or how would that change on a hard court?
I think it skews slightly in Alcaraz's favor on the hard court, just because Novak has inherent advantages on the grass. He can take it a bit earlier, a bit better. And then the US Open hard court especially takes a lot more spin than the Australian Open hard court. So Alcaraz's heavy ball, especially on the forehand, comes more into play. And then he himself gets a lot more time because he likes having time to run around and rip the forehands inside in and inside out. And you don't really get that time on the grass. And you wouldn't get that time at the Australian Open either. Oh yeah, and the court is so slow that you can't really hit through the court. So I'd expect the matchup to tilt more in Alcaraz's favor.
I think a couple of other points I would make on that, and I agree with it, is the U.S. Open should be a bit warmer than Wimbledon is, which should play to Alcaraz's favor. And then also, Alcaraz, I have to imagine every match is going to be a night match, the U.S. Open. Crowd's going to be into it. It's going to be very supportive of him. He's the defending champion. He's like the king in waiting. He's an exciting player. So I think advantage Alcaraz on those two fronts.
Last topic. Asher, you had an interesting comment today. Curious if you can elaborate on this, and I'd like to get Dan's take on it as well. You mentioned that Alcaraz saved tennis. Can you talk a bit more about that?
That was a bit of an exaggeration, but it did feel a couple of years ago that after the GOAT gen, we were going to be in some dark days of Sasha Zverev versus
Tsitsipas
finals, and none of us really wanted that. And the heavy, grindy baseline opposite of all court players. So Zverev, Tsitsipas,
coming to the net,
Medvedev. Although we do like Medvedev, he's one of Cheeky Volley's favorite players. But yeah, having this guy who blends Federer, Nadal, and Novak, I'd say most Federer, and then Rafa, and then Novak the least, but definitely he has some elements of Novak's game. And the fans are clearly taken to him. Everyone loves him. Novak is clearly not very happy that he now gets less support than this guy after he had to deal with getting less support versus both Rafa and Roger. But yeah, I think not just him. I think Sinner and Rune also will be good for the game. They're a bit different too.
Yeah, I think the most compelling elements of Alcaraz as far as sort of handing of the torch when that takes place is, first of all, he's very fresh. He, Sinner, to a somewhat less extent, and Rune are all really brand new. They haven't been going through the tour for a half dozen years or so, the way that Medvedev, Zverev, et cetera, have. So there's that sort of glossiness to them. And obviously, Alcaraz, 20 years old, seemingly humble, family-oriented, says all the right things. It's very easy to root for him in a way that you really got behind Rafa and Roger. And the third thing is that if Alcaraz, it isn't very, very early, but if Alcaraz continues to play at the level that he's shown he's capable of, it doesn't feel as though the top of men's tennis is taking a talent step backwards from the big three. I think that if it was, say Zverev ascending to the top, or Tsitsipas, or some of these other kind of mid-tier guys, we would say, yeah, they're great, they're number one, but prime to prime, Rafa beats them, or prime to prime, Fed beats them. I think that small body of work and a lot more needs to be shown, but if this holds constant, there's an argument to be made that peak Alcaraz could hang against peak any one of the big three.
Yeah.
Yeah, I totally agree about that. And we could do another episode where we've done in the past where we do the Bill Simmons question of I forgot what's the exact fact pattern of that, but we've done the scenarios of like peak Nadal on clay against what peak Federer 07 Australia or Wimbledon, do the same analysis with Alcaraz and goes head to head at any decade. All right, mates, another episode. You guys were on another level again today. I'm struggling a bit today, but you guys are in top form.
Well, thanks, guys. It was a great Wimbledon. I look forward to the U.S. Open. And this one, we'll think back fondly on this one. This is a very fun one to watch.
Dan, are you going to U.S. Open? Are we still trying to get tickets?
I, I'm unconfirmed, but I'm hoping and partly expecting to be there.
Okay.
Oh, nice. I'm going to be there for sure, but no tickets yet.
Well, we'll talk to Mike Levine and he can design another shirt for us to wear and coordinate.
Oh, perfect.
Perfect.
Are we going to do an all-cross one or are we going to commit to wearing a Djokovic shirt?
I think we need to wear one with Djokovic's dad on it. And we would like channel hashtag channel the dark energy.
Yeah, we need to, you know, if any of our listeners knows his dad, let us know so we can
yeah, please
get the guy on the pod.
Yeah. All right, mates. Guys, I've got to run, but this was wonderful.
Cool. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Chance.